From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 40 years ago this week, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. Friday, April 4th marks that tragic anniversary. All week, we in News and Notes will examine how Reverend King's life and death shaped America. In a few minutes, we'll talk about King's hard-fought plans for economic justice and how Black America has fared since 1968. Along those lines, right now with us, we've got Chanel Clark. She's an employee of the city of Houston. She's a member of the Houston Organization of Public Employees, or HOPE, which is affiliated with major unions. Chanel, why don't you start out by telling us what you do for a living and how you would describe your economic situation?
Hello, everyone. I'm happy to be here. I'm a proud city of Houston municipal employee, and actually, it was a bit of a struggle. Before, things was rough, and, you know, I've dealt with many situations and talked to many people about how low we were, you know, actually getting rated as far as other states go, since we're one of the largest cities. So now we have set precedents, and today's a better day.
You know, what do you mean, how low? I mean, what are some of the struggles that particularly African Americans in Houston have been dealing with over the years?
Being 21% behind other states was actually, like, you know, an insult to the employees when you have $243 million set aside, you know, for a rainy day. You know, why a piece of that couldn't go into the municipal employees?
So, how successful was your group, HOPE, in getting more for the workers? I understand recently you had a negotiation.
Yes, negotiations. All this didn't come into play overnight. So every night, every meeting was a power struggle. We've actually achieved more than we had, you know, years ago. So now with the community and active, you know, community leaders, help pave the way to get HOPE started.
Let me bring in Bill Spriggs. He is a professor and the chair of the economics department at Howard University. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
So we are speaking with Chanel Clark. She's an employee of the city of Houston. Now, her organization called HOPE just recently negotiated a contract, a 3-year contract with 13,000 municipal workers. Some of the city workers, including park maintenance aides, library aides, and custodians, are working full time, earning less than $20,000, you know, or $20,500 per year. That's the federal poverty level for a family of four. So when you think about people working full time and not making a living wage, what does that say about the state of the economy, not just in Houston, but in America?
Well, it says a lot about our values and how we have drifted away from sort of basic values in this country. It's very appropriate to be talking with her this week, because, of course, all of us are commemorating the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. And he was assassinated trying to organize public sector workers. He was organizing sanitation workers in Memphis who faced this same challenge. Today, if you said to someone that they were a sanitation worker, you kind of think, well, that's kind of a decent job. But it wasn't always that way. People had to fight to make it that way. And unfortunately, we still have people who mind our parks, mind our libraries, who aren't getting decent pay.
Chanel, when you talk to people who are part of the Houston Organization of Public Employees, what do they think that they should be getting in terms of living wage? I mean, is there a consensus about what people think they should be getting, and why do you think some people feel that they are underpaid?
Well, actually, one of our lowest paid people were actually making $6.56 an hour. And based on that, working for the city, that's, you know, way under, you know, $10 or more, as you see with other small states. And when you talk with them, you know, it's like working so hard, and at the end of the day, you should be able to see that on your paycheck. And in this case, you don't. And that discourages people, make them want to, you know, leave the city or say bad things, because working for a large city like, you know, Houston, it's not much help.
What do you think now, 40 years after Reverend King's death, would change your life and the life of people who you work with?
Well, this is, you know, being the pioneer for other states, this sets precedence on what he was conveying. And actually, this is a great accomplishment. And now that we have this new hope union, everyone is proud, and it's a welcoming union.
Well, Chanel, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
With that was Chanel Clark, an employee of the City of Houston and a member of the Houston Organization of Public Employees, or HOPE. And Bill, you're still with us, and I want to broaden this out a little bit. You recently co-authored a policy brief titled Beyond the Mountaintop, King's Prescription for Poverty. What was the purpose, and what did you really get into?
We wanted to remind people of what Dr. King actually said and his actual economic policy for alleviating poverty. So I was joined by a co-author, Stephen Pitts, who's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center. So we could lay out Dr. King's own words. And, you know, it was great that you had Ms. Clark on, because she talked about people who were working hard but couldn't support their families. And Dr. King understood that we have an economic system that generates poverty. And his critique was not of individuals, but of a system that would generate poverty. And that's what we wanted to do, was to call back his words and to look at some of the things that have changed since his assassination that have actually made it harder for people to get out of poverty, even though they're hardworking. We have a lower minimum wage today than when he was assassinated. Ms. Clark talked about somebody making $6.85 an hour. When Dr. King was assassinated, that wage would have been illegal. In today's dollars, it would have been illegal to pay somebody that the equivalent of that wage. We have a lower unionization rate today than when Dr. King was assassinated. And so it takes courageous people like Ms. Clark that you talk with, who have to go out there and risk everything to try and organize and get people a voice about the way that they get paid. And of course, we know as African Americans that we haven't made as much progress as we did in that brief period in the 60s and early 70s in alleviating discrimination. The barrier still exists to us moving up the job ladder.
When you say discrimination, what do you mean? And the reason I say that is because there's outright discrimination. There's, the sort of structural inequality that comes when people have gone to bad schools and can't qualify for jobs. There's all sorts of different factors. What are you really talking about when you use the word discrimination?
I'm using what you mean by outright, that is discrimination with the actual marketplace. The unemployment rate for blacks and whites differs even once you control for education. In fact, blacks with the same level of education are still roughly twice as likely to be unemployed. So blacks with college degrees are about twice as likely as whites with college degrees to be unemployed. Half the wage gap faced between blacks and whites has nothing to do with differences in education, occupation, region in which you live, membership in a union. It all goes back to differences in being treated differently for the same sets of skills. That still takes place in America, is still prevalent in the United States.
If you were to apply Dr. King's economic agendas to America's economy today, what kinds of prescriptions might be offered, or what might be put on the table as ways to change the economy?
Well, three easy things come to mind because they are so different today than when he was assassinated. First, of course, we mentioned the minimum wage, which while you look at the period from 64 to 68 when he was very active in fulfilling the dream of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, the minimum wage actually went up in real terms. And today, the minimum wage at the time of his assassination would be well over $7 an hour. Higher than it is today. Unionization rates would be higher. We would fix the broken labor laws we have in this country that make it so hard for workers to unionize. And the unemployment rate for African Americans had reached a record low in 1968. That helped to lower black poverty while Dr. King was alive. Today, the unemployment rate for black men is higher than it was in 1968. We have gone from an economy that thought it was bad to have unemployed people to an economy that thinks it's bad to have inflation. And so we have carried out policies that have favored fighting inflation over fighting unemployment. So we would have to return to those policies and the importance of having full employment. While Dr. King was alive from 64 to 68, the poverty rate for black children plummeted from about 66% to 39%. That record of 39% stood for 27 years after his assassination. We didn't lower the poverty rate for black children until after 27 years had passed. And when you look at what we did to the minimum wage, what we did to unionization, what we did to unemployment, it's not a puzzle why the poverty rate wouldn't fall. Dr. King was clear, people have to have a job and it has to pay decently in order to fight poverty.
All right, Bill, we're going to have to keep this really tight, but I want to mention some news of the day. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Alfonso Jackson announced he's stepping down. He's under criminal investigation for allegations of cronyism and favoritism with contractors. Is this going to have any effect on the housing market and some of the instability, the government's approach to that?
Well, it'll take a while to piece together every piece of leadership at HUD. FHA isn't going to be as affected, but some of the other elements of HUD that are put in play right now to try and fight the problem we're having in the mortgage crisis will have a problem without having somebody at the head. So, this will affect it a little bit.
All right, Bill, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bill Spriggs is the chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University and the co-author of Beyond the Mountaintop, King's Prescription for Poverty. He joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today, we've got plenty of controversy on our Bloggers Roundtable. The LA Times is all apologies after running a story that falsely implicated P. Diddy in a mid-1990s assault on Tupac Shakur. Plus, it's hard out here for a reporter. As the campaign trail gets pricey, media organizations cut back on sending reporters to cover the candidates. Joining me now, political commentator Jasmine Canick of jasminecanick.com, Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yersick, creator of afrobella.com, and Robert Redding. He publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. Ladies, gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Hi.
So let's set this off with some hip-hop news. First up, the LA Times ran a story earlier this month that said Sean P. Diddy Combs was part of a brutal attack on the late rap star Tupac Shakur. But it turns out the story was based on bogus information from a prisoner known for bogus information. The Times apologized for buying into the hoax and implicating Combs. So I'm going to go to you, Jasmine. Do you think that Combs essentially should retaliate against the Times, and you know, whether it's a lawsuit or something like that, or is this something that's understandable?
I don't think it's understandable. What Mr. Combs does is ultimately going to be up to him. I mean, I'm not in his position. I'm not. You know, sure whether or not he should sue or not. My personal opinion is that beyond all of this, I mean, this is very embarrassing for the LA Times, okay? Mm-hmm. And I just think that of all the resources or the minimal resources that they have, because they continue to make these drastic cutbacks over there at the paper, if you want to investigate shootings and killings and murders, you know, why not start in your very own city with those that are unsolved? I'm just a little peeved that they put all these resources, false as they may have, you know, come out to be, but into this old story. This is old news. Like, why are we still reliving this? Why is this still news? When we have all of these unsolved murders and shootings in Los Angeles, their very own city, our very own city, where, you know, they don't dedicate any resources to it.
You know, do you feel the same way, Patrice, that basically this is a case of someone gunning for a big story when the newspaper should have been focused on, you know, issues that are more important to people on a local level?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. I work at a newspaper myself. I know how mistakes like this happen. It's hasty reporting. Journalists are put under pressure to churn out these big stories at breakneck speed and to move copies and to get people clicking on those ads, you know, and it is so embarrassing for the LA Times, and their own coverage of it was so self-congratulatory, you know, so Puffy must just be
in
laughing all the way to the courthouse. They had an interview online with, on one of their music blogs, August Brown was interviewing Chuck Phillips, and, you know, Chuck Phillips starts waxing poetic about The Wire and drawing parallels between this case and
Phillips
The Wire.
Phillips is the reporter.
Yes, exactly. And the funniest part is the last season of The Wire was all about kind of the fall of journalism and journalists grasping at straws. So there's definitely irony there.
Robert, when you see this case, what do you see? Do you see, you know, a collapse of some of the newspaper ethics? Do you see, you know, a rightful desire to pursue what happened in the Biggie Tupac years? What do you see?
Well, as the reporter said before me, I've reported as well for a number of news organizations, and I think this is a lawsuit. And while I think the Times will live, Puffy might not live because people don't read corrections the way they read initial stories. And that's what they're going to remember. They're going to remember that initial story. And that's what his attorney's going to argue, because we're talking about possible malice here. And if something happens to Puffy because of this report, blood could be literally on the Los Angeles Times hands.
Wow. Well, I want to move on to more of the, if not blood itself, in some cases blood, the gun culture within hip-hop. The latest rap sheet includes Clifford Harris, better known to y'all as Atlanta rapper T.I. If you don't know the rap world, you might know him from the movie American Gangster, where he played Frank Lucas's nephew. T.I. got busted last year for trying to buy machine guns. Last week, he pled guilty to federal weapons charges. He has to complete at least 1,000 hours of community service. We'll get sentenced next year. Then there's Remy Smith, a.k.a. Remy Ma. She's one of only three female rappers to reach number one on the Billboard charts. That was for a single called Lean Back by the Terror Squad. Now, she's got some bigger things on her mind. She was convicted last week on four assault charges. They relate to the shooting of a woman outside of a New York nightclub last summer. She's sentenced to be scheduled to be sentenced in April. Now, Jasmine, you blogged about them and asked, why can't these successful artists stay out of trouble? So why can't these successful artists stay out of trouble?
You know, I don't know, but I'm willing to bet, though, that their album, this will definitely help boost album sales. I think it's a shame, actually. I mean, you're given this opportunity that very few have, and it's almost as if you squander it. I mean, it's, you know, no different from sort of R. Kelly and some of the other, you know, entertainers that find themselves in all of this trouble. And it just, you know, it really just goes to show that regardless of the money and the fame, that people still don't know how to act, pretty much. You know, they just don't know how to act. They don't know what to do with it. And it reminded me at some point of that old saying that we have, and I might mess it up, but like how you can take the person out of the hood, but you can't take the hood out the person.
Absolutely.
It's almost, you know, bringing that to life. And, you know, I think it's embarrassing. I think it doesn't bode well for people who are sort of looking at us as a community in terms of, you know, our entertainers and rappers. But also on the flip side, like I said at the beginning, you know, it has a weird way of helping album sales spur.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some executives at the top of some chain that are very happy right now.
Well, Robert, you know, T.I. was already a convicted felon, so he wasn't allowed to have guns. Now, as part of his community service, he's going to talk to kids about guns, gangs, drugs. He's not exactly known for conscious hip-hop. Yeah. How well is it going to go over when the man who rapped Long Live the Game stands in front of kids and tells them to stay out of the game?
Well, I think it's not going to be believable, but I think that they will love the CTI in their classroom, clearly. He needs to be doing this, and he needs to really be honest about this and needs to try to really sell them that he's turning his life around. T.I., you know, I have to give full disclosure here. I have a publicist friend who actually is a longtime publicist of mine, Audrain Jackson, a good friend. She also has provided services for T.I., so I might be a little biased on this particular topic, but I think T.I. has to step to the plate here, and I hate to use this old cliche, be a man and grow up here.
But Patrice, you know, there's something more than a little strange about people being convicted and then asking to preach the gospel of, you know, turning around. And I'm thinking here of Method Man. He was convicted. He's another rapper, popular rapper from the Wu-Tang Clan. He was busted holding marijuana last year and sentenced to talk to New York City high school kids and tell them not to smoke weed. Now, this is the man who's rhymed about smoking weed. He did the stoner movie How High. Yeah. I don't know if he walked into the classroom with a wink wink while he was talking about, you know, I mean, how high were the people who sentenced him when they asked him to do that kind of community service?
I think, I mean, I'm sure somebody behind the scenes thought it was a little amusing that they would be sending Method Man of all people to do an anti-drug, just say no type thing. But, you know, sometimes maybe those are the people who you need to hear from versus, you know, the clean cut, you know, I've always been a good person and led this straight and narrow path. Like, those are the people who might reach a kid like that more than anybody else. I think, you know, if T.I. walks into your classroom, you might be more likely to listen to him as versus, I don't even know who's a clean rapper anymore. I don't know, like a Will Smith type guy who you can't relate to at all.
Well, you know, I want to reintroduce the Bloggers Roundtable in case anyone is just tuning in with me on today's Bloggers Roundtable. We've got political commentator Jasmine Canik of jasminecanik.com and Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yursik of afrobella.com, Robert Redding, who publishes the readingnewsreview.com. We have been talking about hip-hop and all of the various manifestations of bad behavior, but there's a flip side, which is when politics and rap can and do mix and there is a little bit more of a positive or political side to it. The rap star Big Boi, half of Atlanta's dynamic duo Outkast, is working on a new album. He's got a single, Royal Flush, and it includes some political verses. You know, he says, impeach the president because he don't think before he talk. Iraq got that. Now he's gunning for Iran. Rob, you do a lot of writing about politics, and this song caught your attention. Why does it have you excited?
Well, because also I have a hip-hop background. I used to do a lot of work from Georgia and to Louisiana in terms of hip-hop radio, and I actually had a hip-hop label once upon a time ago, believe it or not, before I got into politics. So I know the music of Outkast very well. So when I heard this, I said, this is a natural progression, it seems like, for Outkast at this point, because he's made some political statements after Speaker Box, their last album that they did together. Of course, this is his album. So I found it significant when I heard it on Greg Street's show in Atlanta when I was listening online. And I said, this is something that has to be written about. And I think the New York Times is now writing a piece about it in their issue of their newspaper. And I think it's news because Outkast is one of those groups that's extremely popular, and Big Boi making statements like this is something that people need to know about, that rap is kind of finding its legs. People are getting older and getting a little bit more conscious.
Jasmine, what do you think about the whole hip-hop politics movement? Is it going to be big in 2008? You know, you had P. Diddy's, you know, whole citizen change movement 4 years ago. Are you getting the sense that there's a grassroots swell of people who are willing to bring this to the table?
Well, you know, there's always been sort of an underground, political movement in rap. I mean, it just hasn't always reached the mainstream airwaves. And I think... I haven't heard the track yet, but I'm definitely going to check it out. But I think and I'm a diehard Outkast fan as well, with people like Big Boi, you know, that sort of, with his popularity, it could bring it to the forefront. Again, you know, you're talking to someone who truly does believe that the music industry wants to continue to dumb down blacks. And so I'm not that... I don't have that much faith that a lot of, music with, you know, politically conscious messages are going to become the norm. You know, I'm Gen X, so I come out of X-Clan and Public Enemy, and that is what I used to love to listen to. And quite frankly, we just don't get that anymore. I'd be very surprised if in 2008, you know, those kind of lyrics made a comeback. I'd be happy, but I'd be surprised.
Patrice, what do you think?
I mean, I definitely think Outkast is a good group to do it. They take musical risks, and it doesn't surprise me that you're not going to hear this kind of stuff, I think, on the mainstream clear channel type of radio stations. You know, they have been underground rappers who have continued to be outspoken. You've got Dead Prez, you know, Blue Scholars, The Roots, and you don't hear that stuff on the radio. And it's true, like that Public Enemy era, it's a little depressing sometimes when you listen to it now and you hear Flavor Flav of all people saying, don't believe the hype and fight the power.
Right. Well, let's move out to the larger question of how political messages are conveyed. The New York Times reported that media organizations are cutting back on coverage of the White House race. Now, some of the biggest newspapers like USA Today, some of the television stations are thinning the numbers of reporters they send out or the numbers of days they're on the campaign trail. It can cost thousands of dollars a day to put a reporter on a campaign plane. And Robert, you've been following this. And what do you think we lose as media consumers by not getting firsthand, up-close stories from professional reporters on the trail?
Well, first of all, we lose that the last time Obama spoke, he spoke to 20,000 people. And we lose what he said to those people and the things that happened as a result of walking up to the podium and walking down from the podium, and the fact he probably shook just about half of the people's hands, and they probably said some important things to him. Look, I've been talking about the fact that We're cutting back in terms of the presidential campaign for about a month now. And I was kind of poo-pooed by one of your guests. I can't remember who it was. I'm not taking it personal. But the fact is, I saw this thing coming. We wrote an article about it. And I also saw this attack that has befallen the campaign coming as well. Because what I see in the mainstream media right now is an attempt to marginalize and minimize his campaign, for better or for worse, or however you want to argue it, depending on your political slant. I'm an independent, but I think that that's wrong just because these guys might be running out of money.
Now, there's a couple of different issues here. One is about the Obama campaign. The other one is about how news is delivered. But Patrice, when you think about the news delivery, is this just a natural evolution because of the rise of the blogger and the rise of opinion journalism? And should we just not be so sprung over the idea that there are fewer reporters on the bus?
I think the rise of the blogger is definitely, you know, it's a positive thing that's coming out of the overall negative trend. I think there's a direct correlation between, you know, the lack of reporters and last week's story that newspaper advertising revenue is falling at a record rate. You're going to have, you know, more of these incidents of plagiarism, like I think the New York Times recently ripped off the Miami Herald. And it's because you've got more people you're trying to do more with less. So, I mean, it's very important to have those mainstream accepted voices out there, you know, who you can turn to, because a lot of the time bloggers report from the heart. It's opinion-based writing. Do you need somebody who's like, you know, the AP and the Reuters to kind of to try to cover things as objectively as possible?
Jasmine, is there a constituency to push for more on-the-ground reporting? And what I mean by that is networks have been cutting back on the number of international bureaus, as have news magazines. I mean, there's been a general shrinking of the investment in getting firsthand reporting. But who is the constituency for, I mean, are, you know, all of a sudden newspaper readers rise up or something? I mean, is there anyone who's going to advocate for a different standard, if there is one?
Not sure who's going to advocate. I know I'm pushing for our two black networks, or so-called black networks, to try to pick up some sort of daily newscast. I mean, come on, it's 2008. We got a black man running for president. I can't even get any, you know, news from an African-American point of view except for NPR News and Notes on a national basis, you know, on television. Like, that's a gripe that I have when you talk about cutbacks and all that. But one point that was made about, like, the mainstream media cutting back, you know, I also think it's important to understand that mainstream media, mainstream reporters are also very biased, all right? Mm-hmm. There's a big difference, for example, with the L.A. Daily News and the L.A. Times, from the New York Times to the Chicago Tribune. And I think it's also important that you don't just have sort of those mainstream reporters, but there's access to sort of, you know, the less non-traditional folks are allowed at the table as well, because what we haven't talked about in this conversation is where's the black media? You know, if it's $2,000 to ride on a plane with one of the presidential candidates, where does that put, you know, Spanish language media? Where does that put the black media? Where does that put other traditional forms of media where we get our information?
All right. Well, we're going to have to end it there with that provocative question. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We've been talking to political commentator Jasmine Canik, who blogs at jasminecanik.com. Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yursik is the creator of afrobella.com, and she joined us from member station WLRN in Miami. And Robert Redding, who publishes the readingnewsreview.com. He's on the line from the Radio People Studios in Monroe, Louisiana, to the pivotal year of 1968. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Today we give you the final installment of our March series on mental health. We've talked about how to identify symptoms of depression and mental illness, how to get help, and what to do if someone you love is a threat to him or herself. We have gotten some incredible responses from you listening, and today we want to talk about gender and mental health. Are Black men less likely to seek help for mental illness? Are they even willing to acknowledge they might have a problem? Journalist and author John Head has seen this problem from the inside and out. For more than 20 years, he worked as a health reporter at the Detroit Free Press and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But his own personal experiences led him to write Standing in the Shadows, Understanding and Overcoming Depression in Black Men. John, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you write Standing in the Shadows?
Well, it started with a fellowship at the Carter Center in Atlanta in their mental health program. And it's a project where they allow journalists to spend a year doing a project connected with mental health. And I initially was going to do a project about access to mental health care in minority communities. And someone at the center told me that was quite a piece to bite off, so I should try to narrow the focus. And I started narrowing the focus, and I got down to the point where I said to myself, if you're going to do this and you're going to be honest about it, you need to narrow it down to the person you know most about, and that's you. Because at that point, I had struggled with depression. And in fact, I'd gotten treatment for depression, but I had never really told anyone about it. So I wound up doing the book as a project and writing mostly about my own experiences, but also talking with experts and looking at the field and trying to figure out whether there is a relation between mental health and race, and particularly with regard to Black men.
So you've laid out a lot of issues, but just very briefly, what was the pivotal experience that brought you to write about your own journey as well as the bigger picture?
I guess the thing that really allowed me to get to that point was getting help, and I got help only when I reached the point where I was near suicide, where I thought that the only way to end the pain that I was going through would be to take my life. And I, in fact, went through what I considered to be a dress rehearsal for suicide and taking basically all the steps I needed to take my own life. But then reaching that point where I either did it or stepped back, and for some reason I stepped back, and I think I stepped back because I had it in my mind thinking about my three sons and whether I wanted to leave them in that way and leave them with the question of why I had done it, and also even maybe thinking that they may have been the cause of me doing it. And I didn't want that to happen, so that's when I stepped back from that, and that's when I knew that I was in real trouble and that I needed to get help. And I have to say that I had suffered from untreated depression for 20 years at that point.
So what kind of help did you get? I mean, when you decided, in an amazing, powerful way to affirm your life, what did you seek out?
Well, I sought out professional help, which is something that I had resisted for years. My wife had tried to talk me into getting help. And so only when I reached that point where I knew that I just had nowhere else to turn, I got professional help. And I went about it all the wrong way. I just sort of got a list of names of doctors, psychiatrists, mental health providers in my area, and just chose the one who was closest to me. And didn't do any research, didn't do any interview. I just picked that name because she was close. And I got very lucky, though. I got to someone who was very good, very empathetic, and who really started me on the journey to recovery and really a second chance at life.
Now that you're an author and in some ways an advocate, how do you craft a message to Black men in particular that says it's okay to get help? In fact, it's better than okay. It's necessary.
Well, I mean, one thing that I try to do is, I mean, I'm very interested in the intersection of mental health and race. And it's interesting that you were talking earlier about Dr. King, because one of my favorite sayings on that issue comes from Dr. King. And Dr. King said that racism is meant to instill in Black people a degenerating sense of nobodiness. And that degenerating sense of nobodiness, to me, is a classic definition of depression. And so we have these forces at play in our lives that are meant to make us feel bad about ourselves, that are meant to make us think badly about ourselves. And I try to get that message across to Black people, but especially to Black men, because I think we are particularly the target. And it is devastating when we fall prey to it. And I will give you an example of falling prey to it, is that when I was in the depths of my worst depression, there was nothing good about me that I was willing to admit. I thought that everything you could say bad about a black man was true about me. And when you are in that place, when you're willing to accept those negative stereotypes and unwilling to accept anything good about you, you're in a very bad place, and especially for a black person, especially for a black man, because that's the thing you really need to fight against every day. And if you're in a frame of mind where you accept that, you are lost to yourself, lost to your family, and lost to your community. So I try to get people to look at that and to look at getting beyond that and arming yourself to fight that battle every day. And you can't do that if you aren't in that place where you're mentally healthy, emotionally healthy, and can see the world in a way that allows you to be positive about yourself.
So it sounds like therapy is one part of it, and possibly medication if you need it. But would just name one other element of what might take you from a place of pain and self-destruction to a place where you're emotionally and mentally healthy again.
Well, there are many things. I mean, having a, you know, the social network around you, support that people can provide to you, family and friends. But there are also things that you can do. You know, you mentioned therapy, you mentioned medication, and these can be important. But just living a healthy lifestyle, getting exercise, eating properly, if you feel good physically, you are, you know, one step toward that mental well-being, emotional well-being. And you really have to have that. I think you really have to look at it as, you know, the whole person, and not just focus on one aspect. But that, you know, that social network works only if you're willing to call on it, only if you're willing to talk about your problems to someone. And to me, that is always the first step. If you can talk to someone you trust, and that may be a family member, it may be your wife, it may be your minister, but to just start talking about what you're going through and to understand that you are not alone, that you don't have to be ashamed, especially for men. And this is something that we find particularly difficult, to just to talk about how we're feeling emotionally and to admit that we're not always strong. That step has to be taken before you're really on that path to recovery.
Well, John, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you. And thank you for paying attention to this very important subject.
John Head is the author of Standing in the Shadows, Understanding and Overcoming Depression in Black Men, and he joined us from the studios on UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
And I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people we'll get to the promised land.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another.
Too late now. We are ready to start. We're going to finish it up.
Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
1968 was a pivotal year for America. The war in Vietnam was escalating. Dr. Martin Luther King and Senator Robert Kennedy were assassinated, and civil unrest spread to cities across the nation. All these events made 68 the year to remember, especially for young reporters covering the news. Carol Simpson was just starting her career as a radio journalist. Today, on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we're looking at some of the major stories that shaped that year. Joining us to share some of her memories is the now veteran journalist, Carol Simpson. Carol, welcome.
Good to talk to you, Farai.
It's always great to talk to you. So this week marks the anniversary of the assassination. Friday is the exact anniversary. If you go back in time, you were just getting your legs as a reporter in Chicago. What was it like, first of all, being a black reporter in America at that time?
Well, I have to tell you that I was one of the first black reporters in Chicago. There might have been a total of 10 of us, perhaps, at four major newspapers, three major television stations, and three or four big radio stations. So we were an oddity, first of all, to be seen out reporting on things. I can remember people having heard me on the radio and seeing me in person and going, "You're not Carol Simpson, are you?" And I said, "Yes." And they're going, "But you don't sound colored. We thought you were white." And
I'm sure you did.
So I was kind of, and I was one of the first women on the air, so people recognized my voice. But getting back to 1968, it's the scariest year I have spent in a career that has lasted more than 40 years. It was the most frightening time in this country. It's hard to describe. Listening to the sound bites that you had of Dr. King and of Lyndon B. Johnson stepping down as president, and all of these sounds just bring all of this back to me. It's as if it were yesterday, and it was scary.
Well, yeah, there was so much going on, the Tet Offensive.
War, the anti-war protests were, at a fever pitch. The civil rights demonstrations, Dr. King had denounced the Vietnam War and was planning his Poor People's Campaign. There were rich against poor, young against old, black against white. It felt like the country was tearing apart. And then when you have the assassination of Dr. King, and then shortly thereafter the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and then I covered the Chicago Democratic Convention where there was a police riot, what was later described as a police riot, where demonstrators were beaten, and I was among the group of reporters in Lincoln Park that were chased by the police. The police turned on reporters while we were trying to cover their actions against the demonstrators and ended up getting hurt during that melee. And then the Weather Underground, the Students for a Democratic Society, went through the streets of Chicago, smashing downtown windows and that kind of thing. 10 people were killed during the riots that followed Dr. King's assassination in Chicago.
Well, let me...
I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that I heard Mayor Daley talking, and he was the one who said during those riots, "Shoot to kill arsonists and shoot to maim looters," which just sent the city in an uproar.
I wanted to ask you where exactly you were when you heard the news that Dr. King had been assassinated.
I was working at WCFL Radio in Chicago, and it was 6 o'clock, and my husband had picked me up from work. We had one car, and he would leave work and pick me up, and we were on our way home when we heard a bulletin on the radio saying that Dr. King had been shot. At that time, we didn't know he was dead or not. So I immediately got out of the car. We didn't have cell phones, so you had to find a telephone booth. And I called my office and said, "Where do you want me? What do you want me to do? You want me to come back in?" And they said, "No, we want you to go to the west side of Chicago," which is where Dr. King had brought his campaign for fair housing to Chicago. "Go to the west side and see what's happening around there." So we drove to Lawndale in Chicago, and people were out in the streets. The burning and that kind of stuff had not begun yet. But I saw that they were gathering at a big church, and the anger and the tears and the crying. So I reported on the reaction on the west side where Dr. King had been, and it was, you knew something bad was going to happen. I mean, people were really, really angry.
Were you, so often as reporters, you have to put your own emotions aside, at least in the short term. But how did you feel personally?
I felt terrible personally because Dr. King helped me make a name for myself in Chicago. When he brought his campaign to Chicago, I staked out his hotel room all night long. I was trying to get the story, trying to get a scoop, and he actually told me 3 hours before he had a news conference that he was in Chicago to challenge Mayor Richard J. Daley and the city's policy on fair housing. So I was able to get on the air, and it was like the Chicago Tribune and CBS and ABC, they're like, who's this little reporter? Who's this woman reporter? And I had the scoop. And so my name, I owe, I think, a good part of my career to his helping my name get out in public by being the reporter that scooped the city of Chicago on that story. So I knew him, and I had walked with him on the west side of Chicago. And but you know, when you're a reporter, as sad as I was to hear that he had been shot and was dead, you go on autopilot. Your job is to report the news to the public that wants it and needs it and should hear it. So you go on autopilot and you do your job, and then by the time I got home at 2 or 3 o'clock that morning, I just broke down in tears. I hadn't been able to cry because I had to keep working.
Well, Carol, I can't tell you how great it is to talk to you, and certainly we'd like to keep the conversation going sometime soon. Thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Farai.
Journalist Carol Simpson, she is working on an as-of-yet untitled tell-all memoir, and we're certainly looking forward to that.